All right, today we begin in chapter 10, verse 2. Now, in chapter 10, I haven't counted the number of things that he talks about in here, but probably a dozen different things that he talks about and gives us advice on. Keep in mind, really, that the way the book of Ecclesiastes is broken down is the first six chapters is dealing with the what life is all about from a general overall viewpoint. It's taking those big principles of life that all of us seem to be born with. It is inherent within you. It's almost like Calvinism is true, you know, that it's born within you, that nobody has to teach us, that we just automatically know from our youth up there are certain things that make us happy. What are they? Pleasure. Yeah, right. No, you get bored with that somehow or another. I mean, nobody has to sit down and say, now this is what makes you happy. Well, obviously, that's the way we get it is from the society around about us. Mom and dad and brothers and sisters and uncles. And who is it in this world that it does not try to seek happiness with those elements some way or another? So we imbibe that spirit and we just automatically learn those things. So what he's trying to tell us is that those things really are not the things. Talking in big general principles. Then starting in chapter 7, he said, now, once you have learned that those big things, those money, power, pleasure, and so forth, does not bring you happiness, by the way, does he teach that they're no good? Wisdom, power, money, pleasure, and all. No, they're good if they're used properly. And in fact, which is the best, to have them or not have them? To have them, that's right. But to think that you will find happiness if you do have them is a guarantee that you're going to be miserable because they will not bring you happiness. Now, he deals then with the big things. Then starting in chapter 7, he deals with 101 little things. Now, once we have learned that those big things will not bring us happiness, that there's more to life than that, it is doing that which is good and enjoying life on a day-to-day basis, once we learn that, then we learn the 101 little things that keeps us out of trouble, that will help us to enjoy life. Now, if you make up your mind to enjoy life, you say, okay, I've read the first six chapters now, and I understand that these big things of life will not bring happiness. So now I have that conquered, which if you say that, you're lying. But I doubt if we get it conquered all the days of our life. But you say, okay, I have it now put in proper perspective. I realize that all the wisdom and riches and power and pleasure that I could attain will not bring me happiness, that it takes more than that. I'm going to do that which is good. I'm going to be obedient to God. And I'm going to enjoy life on a day-to-day basis. I will enjoy the fruits of my labor. Now, I made up my mind to that. All right. As I now get up in the morning to go out to enjoy life and enjoy the fruits of my labor, how many different things are there that I can do in a matter of 10 seconds that will make me miserable, not only for one day, but for a month or a year? Many, many things, isn't there? I go out and I can do some very dumb, foolish things. So that's what this is talking about in the last. Need to learn. Suffering, that's right. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. So Kathy, just think of all the privileges and pleasures Kathy's had in the last 2 weeks with her little child having that tumor taken out. Isn't that great? And the rest of us have been going to parties and enjoying life and wearing new clothes that we got for Christmas. And Kathy's been laying over there on the couch, you know, about that wide. And she's very lucky. Right, Kathy? Okay, you say, well, no, that just doesn't hold up. Well, I'll tell you one thing it does do. Kathy knows a whole lot more now than the rest of us know in that particular realm. She has an appreciation now that the rest of us do not have. She can look at her little girl and see her through a different set of eyes. And on you go. And as she goes through this 6 months of trauma that she's going to be going through and watching the suffering and such things as this, when she gets out of it on the other side, she's going to be a whole lot better person than she was when she went into this. But does it feel that way? Doesn't feel that way, does it? And you'd give anything in the world to take it back, wouldn't you? See? To be able to take it back, not go through it. If you say, boy, I wish I had it the way that it was. And you ask me, well, Lowell, would you like that to happen to one of your children? What will I say? I just get so mad I'd punch you in the nose if you ask such a dumb question. Now, what I'm saying is this, that there are certain things in life that do help us and mature us and make us look at life from a different viewpoint and make us enjoy life and appreciate life more. That's what the last part of the book of Ecclesiastes is about. I never forget, right after Doris died, in reading those books, there was a statement made in there that everybody would make, and that is that you really can't enjoy life until you have wrestled with death. That you really can't enjoy life. And they point out, now, one of the things that is going to be a benefit to you, writing this to a person that was suffering like I was, one of the things that's going to be a benefit to you is that one of these days you will come out and you will appreciate life more than you ever have because you're going to wrestle with death. Now, that would make me angry. It would just absolutely make me angry. Because what that book was telling me is this. One of these days, you're going to appreciate life more without Doris than you did with her. How does that sound? How would it sound to you if I said, you know what I've learned? I enjoy and appreciate life a whole lot more since Doris is dead. How would that sound to you? Just be a terrible, terrible, horrible, nauseating statement to make, wouldn't it? See? And if a person made it that way, it would. It would just be a slur, a slander. Okay, let's not make it that way. But what they were saying, I can begin to see now. What they were saying is that it's not until you wrestle with death. I mean wrestle with death. Now, when do you actually wrestle with death?
Very near.
When you have to, when it's forced upon you, when it's near. When you actually have to do it. And you don't do it until then. Now, when we go to a funeral, we shadow box with death. I might put it like this. You know, we look at it a little bit. We stop and we think, and it sobers us up for a little while. Then we go back to the same standard of living. And going to a funeral is good for us because it stops us, makes us think about it for just a little while. But that is not wrestling with death. And you don't wrestle with it until you have to, until it's forced upon you, until you lose a loved one. And once you lose a loved one, then it's forced upon you, and you have to go through it. And indeed, when you go through, then you come out of it, and you have an entirely different perspective on life and death. And it does make you appreciate life more than what you did. You see, you look at it entirely through a different set of eyes, and your appreciation can and will become greater, or it will become worse. It will become a very bitter thing, so that you hate life and you hate everything about it. But by doing it the way that it should be, you come out really appreciating that. So one of the first things we learned that you have to be hit over the head with the ball bat. It has to be forced upon you, is the idea of suffering. Okay, now some other things that he's talked about then, we'll just skip over to get down to the thing that we're talking about in here. Now, starting in chapter 10, last week we talked about a lifetime of honor can be undone, reversed by what? One moment of foolishness. So he can just undo it. How long would it take President Reagan to ruin his total historical perspective and admiration and anything else that you want to look at as far as president is concerned? How many things would it take? How long would it take him?
One word.
One statement. See? One thing that he does could just turn that whole thing upside down. And so We always have to remember that. We have to remember that. Now, here's another thing that we need to remember too. Not only will it work that way with our reputation, that you live 50, 60, 70 years with an impeccable reputation, and then one dumb thing can ruin it all. Now, get right down to your husband, wife, and children. How many things does it take after you have treated them the way they should be treated and said the things that you should say? How many statements or how many actions does it take to totally undo the whole works? Think about that. Now, just think about it. Don't think about the big things. You say, well, yeah, all you have to do is go out and commit adultery one time. What does that do to your marriage? You see, you don't come in and say, well, I just did it once. You see, it's a terrible, traumatic thing. But in speaking to your children, how many words does it take, or how long does it take to say something to them that lasts for, well, just undoes everything you say? You tell them how smart they are, how proud you are of them. And you look at their arithmetic when they're in kindergarten. Oh, you brag when they finally get 2 plus 2. Tell them how smart they are. And you're building up their ego. And finally, someday that you're irritated, the football game is on, the score's tied, you know, and it's right down there, and the kid runs in, and you say, you stupid idiot, get out of here. What have you done? You just undid years, you see. So, we need to learn that in every realm of life. Now then, in verse 2, it tells us about a wise man and a fool. It says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. What in the world does that tell you? A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left.
Say like the wise man's heart directing towards the right if it's good, and the left, or the foolish man towards the left if it's evil.
Well, it could be that. I hadn't thought about that. I think it means something else. That's a good thought. This is a proverb, by the way. This is not trying to just teach you where your heart is. It's trying to teach you how to live. And it's trying to tell you what wisdom is all about. Well, if you say, Lowell, where's your heart? Point out your heart. What will I do? Will I go like this, or will I go like this? What would you think of me if I say, you say, Lowell, where's your heart? And I say, by the way, if any of you have any real deep questions of life you'd like to talk to me about, well, I'll be glad to give you the answer to them while I'm looking for my heart. What am I telling you by this? Go ahead, ask your questions, because I know that you really want my advice. What am I telling you? What? That's right. What that is telling you is there's a fool up here. See? There's a fool up here, a fool that doesn't know anything. Now, I might be trying to talk to you about a lot of philosophical questions and so forth, but what does it mean that a fool's heart is at his left hand? See? He doesn't know what he's doing. A wise man does know what he's doing. That's what it's talking about. A wise man's heart, say his right hand, yeah, here's my right hand about. In other words, when you see me looking for my heart, now what do you know about me? I might not know exactly where it is, but what do you know? I'm not acting like a fool, right? I'm trying to find my heart. But my heart is over here. So, wisdom tells you how to live. A fool goes about doing the stupidest thing, and while he's doing the stupidest thing, what does the guy think if he thinks his heart's over here? You say, how's your heart beating? You say, you know, I need to check that thing. What is he thinking in his mind while he's looking for his heart? He's thinking the same thing this guy's thinking over here, right? He's thinking he's normal. He's smart. He has the answer to the life question. He's thinking the same thing. What do you know as you see this? Do you see? So a fool lets himself be known to be a fool. See, that's the key. A fool thinks that he's smart. But a fool lets himself known to be a fool, that you can see it by his actions. He's a guy that looks for his heart over his left hand. Now, 3 says the same thing. Yea, also, when the fool walketh by the way, or down the road, down the street, wherever he's going, his understanding faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. Now, I think we can see, you see what it is? Here it is, I'm up here, a very brilliant, wise individual, trying to tell you, you know, about all the answers of life, and I'm going to check my heart. What am I saying to all of you? I'm telling everybody. You see, regardless of what I say with my mouth, what am I telling you? So as a fool walks down the street, oh, he thinks he's really really wise. Maybe in the clothes that he has on, he's dressed up in a different way. Looks like a clown or something. He's sure everybody admires him. You see, in the way that he looks and the way that he walks, he puts a different bounce in his step, and he knows that people will notice him. And oh, he's a great individual, and always willing to give advice. Always willing. What does a fool think about his advice? What does a person think when they just spill out advice, whether you want it or not?
Really doing you a favor.
Really doing you a favor. Look at all this stuff I've got, and I'm going to share it with you, not even charge you for it. Think how it makes me feel. It makes me feel real good because I'm just overladen with all of this great wisdom, you see. But I am a fool, so what do I say to everybody I meet? I don't walk up and say, hey, I'm a fool, but by my actions, I tell everybody I'm a fool. And so really, both of those verses say the same thing there. That if you're a fool, you can't hide it. Your actions will show it. All right, verse 4 is something totally different. We talked about it before. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for gentleness allayeth great offenses. I think we used Dave Neiman as an example of this, didn't we? He understands this. Dave was born with this inherently within him right here. You know, I was telling you about that time that policeman stopped him up there, and he goes back and gets on his hands and knees and is so kind and gentle to the guy. Okay, what this is saying is that when a ruler's spirit riseth up against you, when a policeman stops you and he's mad, when you go to court and the judge is mad, any time that a ruler gets upset at you, now they can do some awfully dumb things, can they not? They can do some real stupid things. They sure can. Is it possible for a policeman to stop you for running a red light when you did not run that red light? Why, that happens many times. And you know you didn't run that red light. And you've got 67 other people in the car with you that knows you didn't run that red light. It's there. And he says that you did. And you argue with him and you get him mad. What are you doing? Finally tell him. They're telling you, stupid idiot you. Give me the ticket, but you dumb idiot you. Go ahead and tell it. What are you doing? You're just getting yourself in trouble, see? And so what it's saying is that gentleness, being nice and considerate, that is what takes care of great offenses. there are sometimes you read about a court case where for murder. I've read this and it kind of irritates me a little bit when it happens. And one sense I get irritated, and one sense I like it. But sometimes there's a murder or something, great crime, and so the. The judge then throws the book at a guy and said, okay, so he gives him 20 years or something. And then he explains the reason he did it like this. Is, okay, this guy beat this other person to death with a ball bat and then stabbed him, you know, 100 and some times and did all this. And I listened to all of it. They're guilty, absolutely no doubt about it. And I would have given them a light sentence. But I've questioned them, and they don't show any sense of repentance, of being sorrowful. In other words, there's just no sense of sorrowfulness. You know, it's just a haughty, rebellious attitude that the man has in a courtroom. So I threw the book at him. Now, what that is saying is, what if that guy was smart, like most people are smart when they go to court? And have you ever noticed that these long-haired hippies, these rapists, like this Kevin Cole and so forth, Have you ever noticed the pictures that you see of him in the paper? What does he look like? Suit and tie. He looks like an immaculate individual. I look at his pictures and I say, that man could not rape anybody. I mean, that man is really a fine man. They dress him up in a suit and tie. They cut his hair. They present him in a presentable way. They tell him what to say. They tell him to go up to the judge. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. That's it. I'm sorry, you know, that I did this and act this way. What will happen to a judge when you do that? The judge says, even if you're a murderer, you know, why, we'll knock several years off of your off of your sentence. All right? Learn to live, then, without rebellion. 5. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as it were an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Now let's get out of the common, ordinary folks, like we are, and how to live. Rulers have their problems, too. When they have their problems, does it reflect on us? Do we have our problems when rulers have their problems? Sure does. Okay, now it proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich set in a low place. I said, I've seen this. A poor man and a poor man. Guy with a spoon in his mouth. Yeah, you do. You like him better, don't you? Secretary of Agriculture resigned last week. And so in the press conference, why these brilliant newsmen were interviewing the president and asking, Mr. President, are you going to try to get a working farmer to fill the bill? Now, that's a loaded question. Suppose President Reagan says, absolutely not. All a farmer knows how to do is farm. He doesn't know how to run the country. He knows how to grow wheat. No, we're not going to try to get a working farmer. What would that have done to him? He'd run his reputation. I mean, you could just imagine every cartoon in the paper the rest of the time. It would just have ruined his there that he hates poor people and he hates farmers and all of this. Well, what happens if he says, yes, I want a working farmer? If there are any wheat farmers in eastern Washington or blueberry growers in western Washington that would like this job, write me.
Why?
Yeah, but not only has he committed himself, but he's committed himself to disaster, isn't he? How many blueberry farmers know how to run all the farms in the United States and know what the United States government ought to do with all the farm subsidies and all of this? Not one of them. Not one. So, what must he do? Do you see the predicament that he's in? And so, he answered in a very good way. He said, well, we want to get a man that is qualified, and we would love to have a working farmer, you know, if we can find a qualified individual, and so he goes on down the road. But what I'm saying is, it sounds so sweet to say, why, yes, get a farmer to run that farm program. That sounds sweet. But if you did, it'd just be a total disaster. What would the farmer do, by the way? What would the farmer do as soon as he got in there and he gave him authority? I'll tell you what he would do. He'd say, okay, now then it's time for the government to help the farmer more than what they've been doing. You've been helping us all these many years, but now then it has to really be bailed out. And so there'd be massive amounts of money pouring out to every farm, and it would ruin the farm, it would ruin our economic system, it would ruin everything under the sun, you see. It can't be that way. All right, this is what he's saying. He says, occasionally, though, I do see a situation like this. By the way, what have I just said about Abraham Lincoln? I kind of described him to start with, didn't I? Rail splitter, ignorant man, lived out there right up north of where I do, about 15 miles from where I lived, where his daddy lived, way out in the sticks. There could be an exception. He really wasn't an exception. It's a different day and time, but that's not the only thing we need to know.
He had the ability to educate.
Abraham Lincoln was an educated man. See? Abraham Lincoln was an educated man. Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer. Abraham Lincoln knew what he was doing. Abraham Lincoln, yeah, when he was a young boy like I was, he split logs. But look at me. I split logs. How's that impress you? Think about it for a minute. Aren't you really impressed now? Yeah, we cut our own wood when we were out there, see? Really impressed. Boy, man, Lowell, I didn't know you cut your own wood. Well, from here on, I will really admire you. I think you're smart because you're a woodcutter. Right? Okay. Now, Abraham Lincoln did that. He just lived a normal life. Then he went to school. He became a lawyer. And then, do you know what he did from the time he was about 20 until the time he was elected? He wasn't splitting logs. He was a lawyer running a circuit around there, taking care of all of that business and working himself up in state politics. Abraham Lincoln was a brilliant, educated individual. Now, the reason he was brilliant and educated, I mean, since he was, that's the reason he took on the poor man's stature. You see, instead of going in and saying, I want to be elected as president because I have pulled myself up by the bootstraps. I'm educated. I have a law degree. I have traveled the country throughout the state of Illinois. I have run for these offices here. I have all of these qualifications. Now vote for me. He could have said that. Or he goes through the country and he said, well, I'm just a poor man. I split logs and I lived out here with my pappy and I did this and I slopped the hogs and I did all of it. And yet he spoke in such a way and he had the answers that the people knew that he was they knew that he was dealing with it the way it should be. And at the same time he was speaking their language. He knew that they understood their problems. That's what got him in, see. And so don't ever get carried away and say, let's go get a guy that's the most ignorant guy we can get and put him in instead of a rich man. And he said, that's a bad situation. Now, 7. He said, I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking like servants upon the earth. Where really should a prince be? A prince is a ruler. They should be on the horse. They should be in the place of honor. And the servant should be walking. But is that turned around every once in a while? Yeah, every once in a while, that is turned around, you see. And when it's turned around, why, our governmental system is not going to work the way that it should work. But he says it is going to happen every once in a while. What's that guy's name in Iran that they ran the king out? And Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, what abilities did he have to run the government? He was in exile. He had been run out of the country, you see. He was in exile. Now, there's no doubt that the king was a corrupt king. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But when you get down to it and you look at it, what king is not a corrupt king? I mean, name one over there that is not, you see, of this nature. So he was. I'm not upholding the king's immoralities and so forth like this. But what happened was that the king got dethroned and the Ayatollah got put up to be carried through the country. Now, what qualifications did the Ayatollah have? That's a big word, isn't it? Ayatollah? His last name's Khomeini, and his title is Ayatollah. If you're an Ayatollah, you must really be something, huh? You know what it takes to be an Ayatollah? What you do is you quit your job and decide that you will be a religious teacher. And you take it on yourself to be a religious teacher. Go down and dress in a certain uniform so when people come down the street, they can stop and ask you questions. What do you think about this? And so you are an automatic Ayatollah. That's all he was what we call over here, a hippie that got out and started answering questions and caused so much trouble that he was exiled out of the country and then was brought back in this way. That really is his qualifications. Well, what's happened to the country since he's come back in? Oh, man, mass murders and been a war, and it's just a terrible situation. So you say, well, that king was a bad king, and he shouldn't have been dethroned. And, I mean, he was doing terrible things. He sure was. He was doing terrible things. But while he was doing terrible things, the country was at peace, and there wasn't nearly as many murders and so forth as this while that other guy was in there, you see. So what he's saying is, a lot of times, these things are turned upside down. 8. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, And whoso breaketh through a wall, a serpent shall bite him. So this tells you about digging a ditch and tearing down houses. What's the message? He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it. What's that saying? If you try to trap somebody else, you're going to trap yourself. That really is what it's actually saying. What this is telling you is, and he's getting ready to, in this whole section, is to tell you that whatever work you involve yourself in, there are inherent dangers in it. There are inherent dangers in doing this. If somebody came to me and said, Lowell, I'm 18 and I'm trying to determine what to do with my life. I think I will become an auto mechanic because I've looked that over and boy, it looks to me like that is the way to go. Good money and all of this. Do you see any problems with auto mechanics? Well, let's just get into the physical dangers. Are there any things that auto mechanics can normally expect to happen to them? Day in and day out. Some of you guys work on cars. What do you expect? If you knew what is going to happen, you wouldn't work on that car. But what do you know? You work on a car for a week or a month. What do you know is going to happen to your knuckles? You're going to knock the skin off of your knuckles because a wrench is going to slip. When it slips, it's down there in a little place. And wow, oh man. See? You're going to have fingernails that are busted. And various things are going to happen to you if you're going to be a mechanic. It's just that simple. You say, well, I don't want that to happen. I certainly don't want that to happen, so I tell you what I think I'll do. I believe I'll be a rodeo rider. Well, that becomes pretty obvious, doesn't it? Fine, that's a lot of fun. That was always one of my life's ambitions. I always figured that if I could ever get to the place where I wanted to get in life, there's two things that I wanted to do. I wanted to be a rodeo rider and a dog sled driver out of Nome, Alaska. Those were my two greatest ambitions in all of this world. I haven't reached either one of them yet. But if you get there, you understand there's going to be certain things that are going to happen. Well, right on down the line, it doesn't make any difference what it is, right on down the line, you can find whatever work you enter into, there's going to be certain problems involved. Now, you take a job like Oliver's, a jeweler. They have absolutely no hazards and no dangers and no problems, right? Wrong? What could possibly happen to this young guy that's going to become a jeweler? Oh, you do burn your eyebrows then, huh? What else might happen?
Saw blades in your fingers.
Oh, being a jeweler, you know you're going to saw that. Anything else going to happen? See, these things I don't know about. I never worked at jewelry. As far as I know, there's no problems with jewelry. A jeweler never has any problems, as far as I know. They make big money and no problems at all. Do you ever run any jewelry?
Just the expensive.
If they're big and expensive, then you crack them or ruin them or something like this. Well, I don't ever ruin any jewelry. Never do I ruin any jewelry. See? Why? Well, I'm not in that business. Okay. This is something here that is so simple in this section. It just tells you that whatever occupation you enter into, there are certain dangers in that occupation. Now, do you suppose here that he's really wanting us to stop and have a lesson on what occupation you should enter into? Is that what the book of Ecclesiastes is trying to get us to do, to choose a job?
Just saying whatever you enter into, then enter into a life.
That's right. What he's trying to get us to see is that as you go out with life problems, that whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And you can't beat the system. That's what he's wanting us to see. I don't care what you do, you can't beat the system. Doesn't make any difference. That's the picture. Now there's some other things that he'll want us to see in there, but our time is up before we even get started on that. So right there is where we'll close today.